This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
It's Wednesday, September 8th.
7th?
7th. Province Sports Radio. Patrick Johnson, Eric McKenzie. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Apparently don't know the date.
Oh, it's okay.
Thrown off by the return of hockey. Is it hockey back? I don't even know.
I don't know. I mean, they're skating. The training camps are on for the World Cup. That's got to be worth
something,
right? It feels
so forced, Eric.
Does it?
It feels forced. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I guess I should go back and look and see what guys are writing, but have written on previous September 7th. And I it's not just that, like, it's run. This is a tournament essentially conceived by, well, I mean, I know it's the NHL and the NHLPA, but, like, this is, as I call it, the hockey World Cup of Rogers. Like, this is something that they're like, hey, let's do this because people love watching hockey. And I'm sitting here going, okay. But I just, and, you know, we're covering it. Obviously, Mike Tracos from Archene's there and Bruce Garriock's there. And, you know, there's various things going on. And, you know, I think that the Team North America's kind of concept is kind of neat. But I just look at it and I go, do I really need to know about, like, what the power play units are? But that, because that's what guys were tweeting about this morning.
Yeah, it's not like...
I'm a negative Nelly.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, I think people are interested in that kind of stuff because it kind of feeds into that, these glorified all-star teams that you put together. And it's like people kind of like to brainstorm the stuff as it is anyway. Who would make Canada's best power play unit? Who would make your USA's number two penalty kill? I don't know. I mean, I feel like people like to tinker with that kind of stuff in their own mind, but... We're 10 days out yet from this tournament starting? I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit over the top early. I don't know. Is it too early to start caring about this thing? Should we be caring at all? I guess those are the questions.
I know. I have no doubt that more people will watch than we expect because people love hockey. And as someone else, I don't actually know who it was, but someone else pointed out yesterday, people will watch the Canucks and the Coyotes in February. Of course they're going to watch this hockey
for sure
in September. You know, the argument that it's too early, whatever, it doesn't really hold water. There's going to be a lot of people because it's going to be pretty good hockey. The other thing that worries me a little bit is how competitive is this really going to be? I mean, we've seen a number of guys in the last week say, oh, I'm not playing. I'm hurt. They've got some little problem or whatever. And they're saying, I'm not going to risk it, as they do with the All-Star game. Even though they know there are no hits in the All-Star game. I'm going to rest. I need to get ready for my team's season, not Canada's World Cup or Team North America's World Cup or whatever. That's the thing that I wonder, are we actually going to see any hits? Do you know what I mean? Like, I think we are. It's going to be physical, but it's not the Olympics.
It's not, and this is the time of the year that guys are used to kind of just dipping their toes back into the water and kind of, you know, getting their feel for the game back again. It's there's still an NHL preseason to come, so there's going to be. And I think we've talked a little bit about this challenge before. Making this tournament matter enough to the players to see the intensity level that fans kind of expect from the games, considering what's at stake. But when you place it at the beginning of a season, you do run the risk of having guys who aren't as invested as you would like for an international tournament. And I think like we pointed out before, the last time they had one of these World Cups, there was no hockey season that followed. I mean, it was pretty inevitable that there was going to be a lockout for back in 2004. And I think that maybe that almost added to the intensity level of that year's World Cup a little bit because there was unlikely to be any kind of regular season that followed immediately after.
I think the advantage the 2004 tournament had as well is that, you know, it was less than 2 years since the 2002 triumph, which was, you know, the things of dreams,
right,
in terms of how things went for Canada, how the team played, how the tournament went. 2004, now it's, okay, this is the next group. Like, this is the sort of, how could the 2002 team be any better?
Right.
So you had, look, you brought in some young guys. You had LeCavalier, and, you know, that's who stands out for me. And Luongo's the guy, and it's not that generation. It's the new generation. And I think the other thing was, is in the end, there was still so much buzz about sort of playing for Canada.
Yeah.
Like, this was a, you know, could they win again? Can they keep this streak going?
Are you suggesting then there's almost like a little bit of gold medal fatigue for Canadian hockey fans?
In a way, maybe, yeah. It's the drama is not there, I think, as we've seen the last couple times out, that, you know, no matter what we get upset about or worried about in terms of NHL scoring and NHL skill levels and who the best players are, you know, at least at this point, the best players still, in terms of depth, is Canada. Like, we have more really good players than other countries can, and we can afford to make odd selections.
It's true.
Unlike the Americans, who seem hell-bent on making odd selections and, as a result, have a worse team. The thing that I was going to say, though, was I wonder, and I was going to throw this at you, I wonder if there's... I mean, I don't know if there's a way to do it, but I feel like the timing, in the end, is the problem. That it's a bit like the World Baseball Classic, which is a fun thing, and they still do, but it's training camp, and it's before the season, and the players, as you said, are just getting into kind of their hockey groove. They're fit. Like, these guys are all keeping great shape now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like they're drinking and smoking all summer for the most part, but most of them aren't doing that. But to me, It's at the beginning of the season that we're like, oh, okay, this is okay, hockey, great. You know, we're just watching for the sake of being hockey. Whereas if they could find a way to put it mid-season, you take that Olympics or All-Star break, and which is already, what, 6 days now?
Yeah.
You know, surely, I mean, you look at the way they make things work for the Olympics. You want to talk about stealing the Olympics thunder. Play it in there. Make it a crazy round robin series. You know, you host a bunch of games in a city. Not a round robin, just do play downs. You can play through, see how it goes.
Yeah.
To me, that would be an interesting thing. I know it would be challenging and difficult, but...
Would you stop NHL play while this is going on?
Yeah, just have a lot, you know, you take a week off
yeah.
or something. You know, and I'm sure the non-World Cup players would be pumped about it. I don't know. To me, it'd be more. It would already be more interesting than the All-Star Game. It gives the NHL everything they'd ever want in terms of, you know, promotion and sponsor support and all that kind of stuff. It's mid-season. It gives you something interesting in February when a lot of the hockey in February is kind of like, okay, when do the playoffs start?
Right.
Maybe I'm dreaming.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree that it would be a great idea, but trying to convince the folks who are in charge of this kind of stuff would be...
I guess that's
the way to do it would be really difficult.
But what's different between them doing it then and doing it now?
Well, I think for one, like you've got... to a certain extent, this is the Rogers World Cup, and they're hoping that you'll use this as right. your... Like you mentioned, they're hoping that you'll use this as your primer to your hockey season. This is what's going to get right. you invested in the product they put on from October to June for the rest of the year. Like... you're basically starting with the game's biggest stars right out of the gate and saying, here you go, here's the international tournament that we all know and love. It just doesn't have five rings attached to it, and trying to drum up interest at the beginning of the season that way. And I mean, yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, the concerns remain the same for when it comes to injuries and stuff like that. But at the same time too, if your guy gets hurt in September instead of in February, that has a lot more of an impact on your team's fortunes come playoff time.
I guess. I mean, I also you bring up the idea of kind of getting everybody buzzed. I almost worry that it's over priming things.
That's right. That could be a problem too. But that's, I mean,
oh, you got to watch this in October. You know, like, oh, well, forgot about this. You know, like, because it used to me anyway. It used to be you got really pumped. You know, that first Thursday in October, you're like, hockey's back. You know, and you'd watch the first games and everybody, you know, there was kind of a buzz to it. And I wonder if there's still going to be that buzz after having seen, even if it's not the best international hockey, still way better hockey than we're used to in the regular season. I almost wonder if it's just, this is just a case of, in the end, no matter what you think of the sort of the corporate angle that this is trying too hard in terms of you're actually hurting your base product if you're the NHL.
So by like coming out of the gate with like some Canada Russia games, then it's just going to leave people like wanting more when it's Columbus versus Buffalo. Like,
yeah,
a couple weeks later.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I can see what you mean, but I mean, I guess it's kind of like a movie trailer, though, right? You always oversell all the best parts early on. So
people go see the movie anyway.
Exactly.
So. Yeah. All right. I don't know. We'll see. I'm sure I'll end up watching.
Well, yeah, I know. But I
won't be that, like, oh my God, did you see blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I think the enthusiasm level has been a little bit more muted than they'd hoped.
Well, so as I tried to spin, you know, when I did the poll last week in the morning skate, or no, on a separate post about Henrik becoming the captain, likely becoming the captain of Team Sweden, you know, I had 75% of people say no, they weren't excited about the World Cup. By Tuesday, it had shifted down to only 70%. So, you know, 30% of people are really excited. So, well, maybe the trend's shifting there.
Then the interesting thing being that, if anything, Canucks fans have more reason to be excited about this than anything, because they will get their chance to preview the scenes of theirs.
Yeah.
Hopefully. So, I mean, there actually is some real value in that way to Canucks fans. For the other 29 fan bases, I'm not so sure there's even that much of a thread to pull on in terms of, you know, generating some interest. So
the one thing I would say before we move along is that it once you sit back and kind of think about the team that will be on the ice, I mean, I still think the Team North America U23 thing is just, you're trying to make up numbers. But the idea of, you know, that you can put, like, let's see how do we put the kids together? It's kind of cool. I mean, there's a reason why EA has had, you know, build your own team on their hockey games since as long as they've been able to do
for
that.
Sure.
You know, the idea, I think, as you said, of sort of who do you get to put together and who, what ifs, you get to play what if. That to me is kind of, that is pretty cool.
Yeah.
That makes it work for me.
Yeah. Well, I think I went on record very early from the beginning that I'd be cheering for Team North America in this one. So,
Are you stoked about the fact they're going to play both their anthems? Did you know this?
I think we both have come to a consensus a long time ago that anthems in general are just
horrifying. We're not going to talk about Colin Kaepernick. There's been enough discussed about that and written about that. But I'm just kind of fascinated. I mean, what are they going to? They say they've got something for Team Europe. I'm kind of fascinated. What are they going to do? Like, are they going to play the Champions League anthem, or are they going to play? I mean, theoretically, like, I think the European Union actually has an anthem. It's some piece of classical music, I'm sure. But are they going to do that, or will they just have some kind of generic thing that was written on a synthesizer 2 weeks ago?
I don't know. I'm a big fan of generic music when you put it to me that way.
There you go. It's just like random. You know what? Maybe it'll be the Province Sports Radio entry music.
That would be great.
That would be pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, a little guitar for you.
Yeah.
Or exit music, also more guitar. all right. What else we got here, Eric? I'm we talked about a few things in prep for this.
Yeah, we did.
Soccer. I wanted to actually ask you about this. I know you've been away mostly, but Canada obviously last night played pretty well, beat El Salvador, did what they were supposed to do.
Yeah.
Quite, you know, it's been quite interesting watching fan reaction, because I think a lot of it's kind of, wait a second. I mean, I saw Matt Sakaris was tweeting this morning about a few things, and a lot of the points I was really on board with, because he's kind of like, okay, so what would you guys do instead? Pick the second worst players? Like, these are the players.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's like, I get that you want to change the coach. Okay, you can maybe change tactics, but I mean, to me, the problem in the end was that the team simply isn't good enough. They can't finish. They had two goals from five games before coming into last night. I mean, that was the problem. It wasn't that they didn't score enough last night. They should have scored more. But the fact they didn't score more told the story. Matt Sakaris made this great point. So, okay, so you get rid of the players, bring the other guys. Like, what are you guys going to do?
Yeah.
And then someone, it was quite funny, said, well, I just want them to pull off a big win once in a while. And he's like, they did last night. Like, they didn't do exactly what they had to, but they gave themselves a chance.
Yeah.
I mean, it was also contingent on Honduras losing. They were in control of their fate. To me, it's just one of these ones where I go, okay, maybe these are the best soccer players we're ever going to manage. And the fact that we're trying to say we should be great at everything, it just doesn't seem realistic to me.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess it, for one, I mean, you've got a group of younger players coming in. You know, you've got a guy like Kyle Larin who's easy to get excited about, and I mean, but he's still young. I mean, you have to give some of these players time to take root within the national program too. But I also wonder how much impatience there is with the men's team, just because we've seen so much success from the women's team as well. Is like I don't know if it's easy to. Obviously, it's much more difficult for Canada on the world stage in men's soccer than women's. But I guess that you have to maybe look at whether or not then it's reasonable to expect that, you know, Canada be a contender for a World Cup position every year. You know, where do you set the expectations for that men's team in a way that's both something that's achievable and that's not putting too much pressure on a program that's already in tough against the rest of the world.
It is interesting watching the two teams in comparison, and not just, I think, from the standpoint of what's the depth of opposition, but just from how they're organized and how they're put together. And, you know, I think in the end, I think I've said this before, that it's something I've found with a lot of women's and girls sports, is that in the end, they just get on with it. You know, the politics as it is different. It doesn't get caught up in itself the way, you know, men's and boys stuff seems to. Maybe that is just a straight up gender thing. But it always amazes me how in the end, you know, John Herdman came in with the women's side and said, this is what we need to do. This is what you guys need. And I want to do it. And they went and did it. And they have these regional development centers. And he went and picked young players. You know, he picked the best he could. Obviously, you know, Canada benefits from the fact that a lot of our players, we get a lot of our elite players channeling through. And as a result, channeling through like colleges, you know, these youth development academies that we've set up. And in the end, there's a coach with a clear vision of what his team needs to be, and he's able to stick around. I mean, that maybe that's the other problem is that, you know, the coach, Stephen Hart, great example. So Stephen Hart was the coach of Canada. Now he's coaching Trinidad or through the Hex. I don't know how much of that's Stephen Hart, but, you know, there's a guy that came up through our system and knew the system really well and knew the players really well. And how much was he able to actually manipulate the development program? Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Benito Floro, you know, had a whole bunch of comments, said, oh, Canada needs a league. Well, Canada has now five professional teams. And, you know, you still need more.
Yeah.
Because I think his argument probably is that you need more private spending on stuff like that. Whitecaps are doing it with Can, TFC are doing it with Can, but in the end, like, he's not really sitting back and directing. He's just sort of saying, here's some issues. And we're probably going to get rid of them. Because people are like, well, you didn't make the World Cup.
Right. Well, I think it's been kind of agreed, or the consensus is that there just needs to be a better development model for players, especially on the men's side in Canada. So, I mean, one of the more exciting things that you did see over the past couple weeks was what was Jason DeVos' new role. What is it, manager of player development or something like that?
Some kind of guru.
But putting someone in a role that's to try and catch these catch players on the way up between grassroots and the top level. I mean, that's where the link, there seems to be a missing link for the Canadian men at least. And so to have somebody with experience on both sides, you know, at every level of that, it can only be a good thing. And maybe make it more realistic to bring in groups of players that are more capable of competing for a World Cup spot every 4 years.
That's a good point. I mean, it'll be interesting to watch because in the end, it's not like we lack for soccer players in this country. We've got hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. of them. So I have a hard time believing that at the same time we're grasping all of our best players. They're surely players with potential that we're missing out on because the system's huge and it's still needs work. So it'll be interesting to see anyway. It struck me that, you know, out of all this, people sort of, you know, this isn't even like England we're talking about. You know, like, this is a team that has not had a lot of success, and there's a reason why. And a lot of it is because, you know, there's a finishing. There's a lot. We don't score goals. Like, we can play defense. We've always had good defenders, but, like, can't score goals.
Yeah.
And that was a problem in Honduras. I mean, obviously, they were lucky to only lose 2-1, but, it you know, they didn't score any goals away to El Salvador. Like, how does that happen? If they'd won that game, we're talking completely different storyline.
That's true. But at the same time, I mean, when they started announcing, you know, this round of qualification and the fact that Vancouver would be hosting some games, I mean, back then there was, I don't think there was a whole lot of, and there was a whole lot of optimism that they were going to advance to the hex then. So, I mean, it's, it does seem like you're going to get upset about the result. I mean, you have to, you know, remember what the expectations were going in, and they weren't very high.
That's great. I mean, great point, because I mean, I went and looked at the other, pools. Like Guatemala, so Trinidad and Trinidad was in the same pool as the U.S., Guatemala, and St. Vincent and the Grenadines. And going into last night, there was an outside chance for Guatemala to go through if they won by like 12 goals and Trinidad beat the U.S. And it didn't happen because
shocker,
it didn't happen because there was all these hilarious like scenarios basically where you know they could catch. I can't remember how it worked. It doesn't even make sense. But Guatemala went out and scored 9 goals, you know, because St. Vincent was terrible. Like, St. Vincent's terrible. They're worse than El Salvador. If Canada's in that group, maybe it's a different story. I don't know. Yeah. And then again, maybe Honduras. You know, it's just, you look at the strength of a number of those other groups, and you're just like, how did this happen? You know, like, how did Canada end up with Mexico and Honduras? They could have ended up with, like, Trinidad and the U.S. and St. Vincent. You know, right. And they probably beat Trinidad. So it's a bit of its luck of the draw, but you know there's I don't know what people in the end, like you said, I don't know what people expected. So yeah, it'd be worth seeing. All right, Eric, what else we got? I can't remember. There's a couple other things.
Well, we have been talking a little bit about the pool in Rio, which I think is an interesting story considering that the Paralympics start today.
Yeah.
Do they not?
Yeah.
And basically that there's been some suggestion that the lower numbered lanes in the pool in Rio provided an advantage compared to the higher numbered lanes.
So like lanes 1 to 4 versus lanes 5 to 8.
Yeah, it was more like lanes like one to three, like right. And then the middle lanes were fairly neutral, but the extremes were at the outside lanes. And while you could, although like in you would suggest it would suggest that while you're doing a lap back and forth in the pool, you're going to have all those kinds of currents or whatever working against the swimmer will even out going back and forth in a pool. You've also got races like the 50-meter freestyle where you're only traveling in one direction, and then you had some athletes with an advantage and some with a disadvantage up to as much as a tenth of a second, which is a ton of time in swimming, obviously.
So when you brought this up last week, you texted it over to me and said, hey, this is kind of a neat story. And my initial comment was, like, I'm kind of amazed by the life cycle of the story, because there was a swimming guy, analyst, I don't even know really what he is, but a guy who's into swimming, and he did a bunch of sort of data analysis on swimming times and compared the real lane times to other events in recent memory. There was I think the World Championships in Barcelona in 2013, there were issues with the pool that were identified at the time,
right,
with currents, and it seems pretty clear that they had similar problems in Rio. And yeah, as you said, you know, the lanes are 1 and 2 were much slower than lanes 7 and 8, or was it the other way around?
Yeah, I can't remember. In one direction, yeah. But then the other opposite was true going the other
way. So, you know, it was you know, basically that there was some kind of circular current in the pool, which shouldn't be there, because, you know, obviously designing swimming pools is a challenge when it comes to doing stuff like that. Like, there's a science to it because of the way currents work.
Mm-hmm.
And something was awry in the real pool. But you know, he wrote about that almost, I think it was right at the end of the Olympics, basically. And then it popped up last week. I was like, how did this take 2 weeks for people to notice? He'd written on a minor site. He'd written on SwimSwam, which is a pretty well-read swimming website. But it took, you know, like a week and a half, it felt like, or 2 weeks almost for I think there was a story. I think most people probably saw it from the Washington Post, but I know it popped up in a couple other places.
Yeah.
And it just impressed me. I mean, it was kind of a nerdy news cycle thing, almost wonky, kind of like, how does this work? But
it's true, and I am kind of surprised that there hasn't been more chatter about it, just given that, you know, I assume they're using the exact same pool with the same current issues
for
Paralympic swimming. So, but the other part of it for me was it made it, I was really interested by the fact that you have some sports where you need the this absolute level playing field for it to be considered fair, and then you've got other sports, like in the Olympics themselves. I mean, they just added golf, which is possibly like the most variable conditions type of sport that's out there. I mean, where the weather has a huge impact on and when you're playing, it's a huge impact on how you're going to end up scoring that day. Whereas this minor this minor current in the pool that has been found, I mean, to the difference of a tenth of a second is being looked at as viewed as really unfair. Like the guy who did the study says he's a huge swimming fan and he's really disappointed for the sport as a result of this.
It's, you know, one of those ones where I think it's such a small thing for most people. They're like, great,
I don't care.
Why do I care?
Yeah.
Was my country screwed out of medal? Well, Ryan Cochran swam in one of the lanes that was affected, but Ryan Cochran ended up finishing sixth in his race. It didn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, in the 50, people talked about the 50, and it might, and I think there was some sort of notion that maybe it did make a difference. You know, there was, the finish was so close. But I think in the end, people are like, deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, swim faster.
Yeah.
I guess it's, such as life. The an interesting, so you mentioned Paralympics starting up. An interesting comment from a colleague yesterday who kind of said, you know what? I think a lot of the Paralympics, it's kind of ridiculous. It should be in the Olympics. Like we use apparatus in the Winter Olympics. You know, what the hell is luge and bobsleigh? Like, why don't we have the wheelchair sprints in the Olympics? Like we just kind of say, well, you guys are different, so you guys go over there.
Right.
And I was kind of like, I kind of like that idea. I'm like, you know, let's just have it all at once. Like, yeah. If we're going to create all these classifications, we already have classifications in swimming. Why don't we just run it? I mean, obviously it'd be an insanely huge event, but let's just run it all at the same time.
Yeah, it's not a bad approach. I mean, there are a lot of logistics to think of in terms of adding several thousand more athletes to the villages, and you know, scheduling these venues are already pretty tight as it is. But I'm sure you can make it work. I mean, maybe that means adding a couple of days to the Olympic program. I don't know, but I don't think that's a. I guess there are a couple of ways of looking at it too. Is that there, on one hand, I don't feel like Paralympic athletes probably get the attention they deserve because they have tremendous stories. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them has a tremendous story behind their journey to the Paralympic Games. But at the same time, then if you put them with all the rest of the Olympians, then do you overshadow them too much, or do they gain extra exposure by being there alongside everyone else? I don't know what the answer is there.
I think they would get more exposure. I mean, I don't know. In the end, the logistics one is a huge deal. I was having lunch with someone who was talking to a person who had been involved in, you know, the logistics at the Olympics. I mean, this is an ex Vancouver Olympics sort of person, and they said the meal hall at the Olympic Village was just this. You're unbelievable how big it was. It was, you could take, I mean, I'm trying to think what his actual comparison point, you know, it was like you could take, you know, one of the larger sort of venues. So like Kraft down in the Olympic Village, right?
Yeah.
Which I don't know what it was during the Olympics, but, Kraft is a large restaurant, you know, bar. And he said you could take like 20 of those or 10 of those and fit it inside the beer, like the tent that they use for the food hall at the Olympics.
Wow.
So you want to add in like that's a tangible logistics challenge. And you'd absolutely, I think if you add the Paralympics in, you're going another week. The Olympics become a 3-week behemoth. And I don't know if I could handle 3 weeks of the Olympics. You know, it was great, but and we talked a bit about it. Like we had nothing else to do, but honestly, like once it was done, I was like, okay, it's been a hard,
yeah,
it's been not hard. It's been a solid 2 weeks. I don't know if I could deal with a third week of it.
Yeah, that's a lot of time to stay invested in those games. And I'll be trying to catch as much Paralympics as I can. Though that being said, over the next week or so,
we've got Dan Barnes down there from Post Media. I know Laura Ewing's still down there from CP, so we'll have a good amount of stuff coming through. And it'll be interesting. All right, Eric, what do you got in your column this week?
I don't know if I'm going to have a column this week. Like I said, I just kind of got back settled from vacation, but I do have a Q&A with Trevor Linden appearing in Megaphone magazine this week. I believe it's out now. I came back from vacation to a copy on my desk, so I'm guessing it's available now. It's not a hard-hitting hockey interview, if that. So don't come complaining to me if you don't like it's not a lot of hockey content in there. We're talking a little bit about Trevor's advocacy and stuff through his foundation and whatnot. But kind of an interesting change of gears to talk with Canucks president. So
yeah, you know, obviously Linden has been a guy who's been involved for a long time. You know, he takes a lot of heat, I think, these days for what's going on with the team. But a guy who's always been involved. Anything you know in particular stand out about what you learned from him?
Well, I don't know if I've ever really had a chance to chat with him much about some of the philanthropic type of work that he's been able to do both through the Canucks and through his own foundation. And it is pretty cool that that's an important thing for him and how much of an importance the organization puts on it as a whole. I mean, that was really a point that he stressed, is that that's been something that's been in place in the Canucks organization since long before he arrived, and, you know, credited guys like Pat Quinn and Stan Semile before him for kind of picking up that torch and the guys that have come after him too. So he had a lot of interesting stuff to say about some of his advocacy and the team's advocacy and just trying to be a good partner in the community. So it was an interesting discussion.
All right, folks, he's on Twitter at Eric McKenzie. I'm at Rising Action. You can find all our podcasts, ProbablySports.com/radio or at iTunes. You can search for Problem Sports. We're on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn. There's a link on the page if you're using another podcast player. If you are using iTunes, please give us a rating and review, even if it's terrible and you hate the sound of our voice. It helps us bump up the list. Eric, we'll see you next week.
Sounds good.